For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
My name is Jim Wallace, and I have been working in Los Angeles County for about, well, it's been 30 years ago when I started. And I still have two open cases, but I work cases that are just homicides, and they're unsolved homicides. These are the kinds of cases that were opened up 30 years ago, and then they never got solved. If you like Dateline, you've probably seen some of our cases, because I've been on Dateline more than anybody else in the country. Not because I wanted to be, but we happen to be in Los Angeles County, and Dateline's in Universal City, so we're close. But these are the kinds of cases that teach you something about how to put together and make good inferences from evidence. And I was not a Christian until I was 35. I didn't even have anybody in my family who were Christians. I didn't know anything about what church was like, what to expect. But I didn't know how to put together a case. And so I started to look at Christianity as a case. And I became a Christian ultimately. And tonight what I want to do is share with you some of the tools that detectives use to make cases. Because I think it can tell us something about whether or not God exists. Now, Dennis talked a minute ago about, you know, making inferences to what's the most reasonable. There's a big difference between reasonable and possible. We'll talk a little bit about that. My son is still doing the same job that I was doing for years, and we were so cheap, we hate to buy name tags, so he's wearing my name tag. By the way, don't laugh at that. Didn't Sean tell you? Sean McDowell. Now, his name is Jim Wallace, okay, so he can wear my name tag. He's wearing basically the same uniform I wore. He's using the same tools I wore before him. Of course, if you're in the 80s, you had to have a really cool mustache like that, okay? And I was using the same shirts and name tags that my dad used before me, because there he is, the same name tag, same shirt, same agency. If you called our agency since 1961, there's been a Jim Wallace to answer the phone. We have been there that long, 57 years. Now, a lot of what I talk about, I write about. Well, thank you very much. I write about this stuff on a website called Cold Case Christianity. I am not here, believe it or not. I never trusted as an atheist Christians who are selling things. Now, God's got a sense of humor because now I'm a Christian who's selling things, right? Because I have books. But that's not why I'm here, and I'm going to provide you with a bunch of free resources. I'll give you the link at the end. So this video, the long version of this talk, all the stuff we're going to do in the next 2 days, I'm going to send those to you as videos, okay? So you don't need to take comprehensive notes if you're not a note taker. If you are, and that helps you learn, take good notes. But I'm going to send you this stuff. Now, yes, we wrote about it in books. I actually have a phone app for this, so you can go online, and everything that's offered on our website is available for free at the phone app. If you want to ask me questions later, probably the best way is through social media, because I'm on every platform there is. Now, about 2 years ago, I was asked to do a short scene in a movie called God's Not Dead 2. Now, what we were given was 6 minutes to make the case that kind of like what Sean did last night, where he was talking about why the Bible is reliable. If I asked you to tell me, why do you think God exists? Can you give me some reasons, some really comprehensive, some evidence for why you think God exists, but you only had 6 minutes to do it? Could you do it in 6 minutes? Could you make a case for the soul? You've had some evidence tonight. Can you repeat it in 6 minutes? That's the goal, is really to have enough awareness, enough understanding of the evidence to be able to make a case when one of your friends asks. That's what we want to do tonight. And a lot of what we're going to talk about comes out of a book that I wrote called God's Crime Scene. But tonight, I'm going to teach you from a different book. From this book, a book that really is going to be talking about how to work death scenes. As a matter of fact, before we do anything, I'm going to teach you to be a good homicide detective. We're going to do a little bit of Death Investigations 101, okay? Are you ready? In order to have a death investigation, we have to have a dead body. So we're going to show you a dead body. I'm sorry. Are you ready for that? Here, you ready to go? You don't ask a homicide detective to come to an event if you don't want to see a dead body, all right? So here's a dead guy laying face down. He looks suspiciously like my son, Jimmy. Do you guys have Trader Joe's in Ohio? So you know nobody would ever kill a Trader Joe's employee, right? We would starve at our house if there was no Trader Joe's. But now, how do I know that this is a crime? It may not be a crime, because there's lots of ways to die. Only one way is criminal. Not every death scene is a crime scene. How do I know if it's a crime scene? Well, you have to make a list in your head, two lists, both that begin with the letter E. One list is going to be of evidences. Now, here, I do have some evidence so far. After all, I've got a dead guy laying face down. That's not bad. Not a bad start. So I can make a list of all the evidence in the room. I'll put it over here. And I can also make a list of all of the explanations for the evidence. That starts with the also. That's over here. So now what do I have so far on the evidence side? Well, I have two things. Dead guy laying face down. That's it. How do I explain dead guys laying face down? Well, there are four ways to explain dead guys laying face down. He might have died by some natural cause. He might have died accidentally. He could have committed suicide. Or he could have been murdered. The question is, which of these is the best explanation given the evidence I have so far? Are there any explanations here? Now, given what I know, are there any explanations here that I can cross out? Just cross them out. They're not reasonable anymore. Suicide. Well, if he intentionally took, by the way, we have, I think we have Maria and Dee who are doing the signing, okay? So if I talk really, really fast, they cannot keep up. So I'm going to talk so fast that there's no way they can possibly keep up. Lots of technical words, forensic words, forensic science words, there's no way you can keep up. Are you tired yet, Maria? No. She's okay. I'll get Dee next. Okay. So now I think if he intentionally killed himself by taking too many pills, he would look like this. If he had a heart attack, he would look like this. If I poisoned him with too many pills, if he accidentally took too many pills, he would look like that. Do you see how right now I cannot cross out anything? All of these explanations are not just possible. They're all equally reasonable. Let's change the scenario. What if he's a dead guy laying face down, but now he's in a pool of his... What are you grimacing for? I haven't even done it yet. You got the look on your face like you don't want to see what's coming next. I haven't even done it yet. I haven't even explained it. He's just going to be in a pool of his own blood center torso. That's not so bad, right? Okay, so now we've got to add this additional piece of evidence. Can I cross out any of my explanations? What can I cross out? Yeah, I mean, is it possible this is an... Look, if he had an aneurysm and he hits the deck and he bleeds out through his nose, it still would not be around his body. It'd be around his head. Where's a natural place in your center torso you can bleed out? I mean, it's possible, but it's not reasonable. We're going to cross one out. The other three, though, I think are still in the game, right? Because I got to kind of roll them over and see what the injury is before I can tell you if I can cross out anything else. Agreed? Is this the weirdest talk you've ever heard on the existence of God? Let's change the scenario. Dead guy laying face down in a pool of his own blood. He's got a single gunshot wound, center torso, and it's an exit wound coming out of his back. So we have now a few things we can add to our evidence list. A bullet hole is an exit wound, and a single gunshot, the gun's on the ground. Can I cross out anything? I mean, he might have thought it was unloaded when he was handling it, and he accidentally shot himself in the chest. That's an exit wound. Only one round is fired. He could have killed himself. He could have been shot by somebody else. I think all three are still in. Let's change the scenario. What if lying next to the body, in addition to all of this, boy, you guys are quiet. We have a suicide note, and it's written on a piece of paper that we find elsewhere in the room. It's written in his handwriting. His fingerprints are on the paper. Would that change things? So now we add this additional piece. Let's put it on our list. We have one list of evidences, a list of explanations. Can I cross out anything? I can cross out accidentally. Look, he might have accidentally killed himself prior to intentionally wanting to kill himself, but it appears that he wanted to kill himself. So I can cross out the accidental. Are you guys convinced now this is a suicide? There's a suicide note. Right? How do you explain the suicide note if he's not a suicide? Somebody forced him. They must play criminal minds here in Ohio. Am I right? Stupid show. If you watch that show right now, raise your hand and get out of the room, walk out of here in shame. Seriously? That is the stupidest show. You think it... Okay, let's go back to our scenario. What can I do to convince you? Okay, how about this? Just to change the scenario slightly. What if we examine that note and it's not in his fingerprints. It's not on his paper. It's not a pen we can find anywhere else. It's not his handwriting. It's got unknown DNA, unknown skin cell transfer, unknown fingerprints on the paper. That would change. How about this? What if he had multiple gunshot wounds? And they were all not exit wounds. They were all entry wounds on his back. What if there was bloody footprints leading out of the room? Do you think that would change things? You can tell this is a California murder right here. That's the beach out there. That's Malibu. You're going to go surfing afterwards. So we got to add these additional things. Now we have multiple entry wounds, not exit wound. We have footprints and bloody and a foreign fingerprints on the note. We'll put those all on our list real quick. And now do you see how I really have to kind of rule out? It's kind of hard to shoot yourself multiple times in the back and then walk out of the room in your own blood. So I can cross this out. And now I've got a good, reasonable inference. This process of comparing explanations to the evidence in the room to decide which explanation is the best inference is called abductive reasoning. Abductive reasoning. We do this at every crime scene, every death scene to determine if it's a crime scene. We ask jurors to do this. Which explanation is better, the prosecutor's explanation or the defense attorney's explanation? So we do this all the time. There's also something else we did here which you might not have caught. So I want to explain it to you in a simple way. This is a process of logical reasoning in death scenes that I call inside or outside the room. Inside or outside the room. Here's how it works. If I can explain everything that's inside the room by staying inside the room, it's probably not a murder. Make sense? Let me show it to you a little more graphically. Let's say we have, this is all reduced down to a room that's actually a box. Now we're going to play this game, inside or outside the room. If I can explain this stuff that's in the box, in the room, by staying in the room. So for example, if I said, okay, there's this note, but you know, it's in his fingerprints, his handwriting. That paper is a pad of paper that's just a few feet away on the table. It's a pen that's also more pens just like that in the room. I can explain that note by staying inside the room for the explanation. He wrote it. Doesn't even need any help. It's only got his fingerprints on it. And if somebody said, well, yeah, you know, that's his gun. He keeps it in a safe in the room. He's had that gun for 10 years. He loves that gun. And it's registered to him, and he's got the only fingerprints or any kind of skin cell transfer on that gun. Well, now I can explain the gun by staying inside the room. It's his gun. And anyone can shoot themselves once without any help, right? He can do that by himself, alone, in the room. If I can explain everything we see in the room by staying in the room, it's going to be one of these three explanations. Now, clearly, it's not going to be a natural, but it'll be one of these two. Are you with me so far? Now, if I have to switch it, though, and I cannot explain the stuff that's in the room by staying in the room. So, for example, if I said, well, yeah, you know what? That's not his fingerprints. That's not his handwriting. That's not his paper. It's not his pen. I don't know whose fingerprints are on that note. It's not his. I got to go figure out where that came from. And if I said, okay, well, I talked to his family. He's afraid of guns. He doesn't own that gun. He's never owned a gun in his entire life. This guy is anemic to guns, okay? And sure enough, it's got no skin cell transfer from him. It's somebody else that's on that gun. Now I got to go figure out whose gun it is. And, you know, it's kind of hard to shoot yourself multiple times in the back by yourself and then walk out of the room in bloody footprints. Clearly, I've got to go outside the room to explain the stuff that's inside the room. And when this happens, it shifts to homicide. Why? Because now we've got a good reason to believe that we've got an intruder. And intruders change everything. Intruders are the very thing that turn death scenes into crime scenes. Make sense? And if you had some sense of curiosity about how somebody could accidentally kill themselves or why they would kill themselves intentionally, I'll tell you what, once you know you have an intruder, your sense of curiosity needs to change into a sense of urgency. Because there's one show out there that actually does pretty much capture what we do. It's not as exciting as Criminal Minds. It's called The First 48. Have you ever seen it? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like boring. You know, it's like some guy with the camera following around detectives doing their job. But if you don't solve it in the first 48, it gets hard to solve. As a matter of fact, that's why when I start a case from 1970, good luck. That's why it's cold. That's why they're unsolved. Now, I started thinking, though, as a guy in his late 30s who was looking at the evidence for the first time about the New Testament, about the resurrection of Jesus, about the possibility, the reasonable expectation that God could enter into the universe and work a miracle on the resurrection, and I didn't think it was possible. But I thought, could I take this approach that I use at every death scene and use it to examine the evidence for God? In other words, what if the scene is not a homicide scene, but the entire natural universe? Can I explain everything that's in the room by staying in the room? If I can, then there's no reason to invoke a creator. Now, I actually think there are 8 things that we have to explain either about the room or that are in the room. And everyone has an obligation to explain these things. And the answers are only going to be in one of 2 places. They're either going to come from inside the room or outside the room. If they come from inside the room, then your atheistic naturalism is fine, because all the room is made of is space, time, matter, governed by physics and chemistry. Space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry, that's the only stuff that's baked into the cake right now if you stay inside the room. So you have to explain all of these things with nothing more than space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry if you want to deny an intruder. The first thing you got to explain is, how did the room get here? We're going to talk about that tonight. The second thing you got to explain is, why does the room appear to be designed? We're going to talk about that tomorrow morning. You also got to talk about how life originates in the universe from inorganic dead matter. That's a problem that everyone's got to solve. And we've been doing origin of life studies for about 60 years, and we're not any closer now. The more we learn, the further we are from an answer. And then you got to explain why biology also appears to be designed. Now, everyone admits this. Even Richard Dawkins, the famed evolutionary biologist, will tell you that biology is the study of things that appear to have been designed for a purpose. But he denies they actually were. But the appearance of design is not controversial. You just got done talking about the existence of soul. Well, forget about souls for a second, because a lot of people don't believe in souls. But do you believe in minds? Consciousness? This is why this is called the problem of mind amongst naturalists, because it's a problem to explain. How does nothing exist, and then suddenly something pops into existence called mind? And if you do have minds, it means you have free agency. Dennis talked about this a little bit. If you're just a material brain, then all you have working are things called event causation. In other words, when a domino falls, it falls against the next domino. This domino has no choice in the matter. If it's fallen against, it must fall. That's event causation. Aging causation says, I'm not going to fall. Nope, uh-uh, I'm not doing it. I'm a free agent. I say no. Nay, nay, I'm not going to fall. But if we're just molecules, if we're just brain matter, then your neurons are firing. And Sam Harris, who Dennis talked to you about, he's a neuroscientist and a philosopher, and he doesn't think you have a mind, and he doesn't think you have free agency. Dennis talked about that in the last session. But also we have to talk about, well, are there objective, transcendent moral principles? And we have to talk about the thing I'm going to do my breakout tomorrow, which is the problem of evil. If you think that God exists, doesn't this kind of eliminate, though? This is kind of like the alibi that the agent has. Because if there's an all-loving, all-powerful God, there should be no evil. If there's evil in the universe, something's wrong with your definition of God. We'll talk about that tomorrow in the breakout. I want you to see, though, that 2 of these are entirely cosmological. That's what we're going to talk about tonight and tomorrow. 2 of these are biological. 2 of them are mental, and 2 of them are moral. 4 different kinds of evidence, 2 in each category. All of these have to be explained, and you only got a couple of choices. Can you explain them by just staying inside the box? Can I get these things with just space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry? Or do I have to jump outside the box for the best explanation? And if you do have to jump outside the box for the explanation, now you've got an intruder problem. Only this intruder spans the entire cosmos, which is why I called this book God's Crime Scene. And I got some flack about it from my publisher. They didn't want to use this name. They thought it implied that God was doing something wrong. No, I'm simply saying you could investigate the universe like a crime scene to see what the best explanation for cause is. Make sense? So let's jump in. We're going to use this model abductive reasoning, only instead of using a crime scene with these explanations for death, we're going to use these 8 pieces of evidence. And there's only 2 ways to explain these. Either we stay in the room for an explanation, or we go outside the room for an explanation. And since we can't cover all of them, we're just going to cover one in this session, okay? We're going to cover the first one. We are in a universe that has a beginning, and all of us have to explain it. I had a case a number of years ago. I think it was the first case we did on Dateline. And it was a case in which at the crime scene, next to the body of my victim, her purse was laying next to this, and she was working in a fast food restaurant, and a purse was lying next to her body. And next to the purse, which clearly had been rummaged through, there was a piece of foam rubber, curved. The case went unsolved. But when I opened it years later, I think about 15 years later, I looked at the crime scene photographs and I saw that piece of rubber sitting on the floor next to her body. And I said, we've got to explain that. That to me does not seem to fit. It's like with that old game on Sesame Street. Which one of these things is not like the other? This did not fit in the crime scene. I was trying to figure out, how do we account for this piece of foam rubber? Well, long story short, I went out and figured out who my suspect was, and I went, and he luckily had been arrested maybe about a week after our murder. And for some reason, they kept his clothing for 15, 16 years in property. So I went downstairs to property, and I discovered that in the work boot that he was wearing a week after the murder, it was missing foam from the cuff. That piece of foam. When he bent down over his victim, and his ankle rode up on the back of his shoe, popped the foam out. He didn't see it come out. He left. All I had to do was match the foam to the shoe. Now, this taught me a lot about the idea of origins, because I'm trying to figure out, how did this originate in the crime scene? And it turns out there are 3 questions we ask when we ask the question, how did this something originate? We ask the first one, which is simply origination. How long has that thing been there? Because if that thing was there before the intruder even came in, if that foam was just laying on there because it came out 1.5 hours before it got placed there, then it doesn't belong to my suspect. It's of no use to me. I need to know, how long was that thing in that crime scene? 2, I have to look at the second question. What or who caused it to enter the scene? And 3, why? What's the behavior? Why did the evidence appear in the scene at all? And does it tell us anything about the suspect? These are the 3 questions we ask when we see any piece of evidence in a crime scene. This is just standard police protocol. Make sense? You could ask the same questions about the universe, and we could start with this first one, which I think is the most important one. And that is, how long has this thing been here? See, for a long time, people thought the universe was eternally old. It had always been here. Like Carl Sagan says, all that ever is, all that ever was. Is that the case? Well, we now have good evidence, good scientific evidence that shows us that the universe has not been here forever into the past. It has a beginning. As a matter of fact, there are actually 6 or 7 good lines of evidence that point to the fact that the universe has a beginning. This evidence is so strong that the idea that the universe came into existence from nothing is now the standard cosmological model, although there are some people who deny that still. That is still the vast majority of cosmologists, astrophysicists, accept this reality. As a matter of fact, Alexander Vilenkin, who's at Tufts University, says it this way: with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Why is that a problem? We'll see in a minute. I think Dennis had mentioned Roger Penrose. You know who Stephen Hawking is. Almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Now, you hear that word Big Bang, a lot of people in the church are like, oh, I don't believe that stuff. Big Bang, I don't believe that's like, that's that atheist stuff. No, actually, the Big Bang is intriguing to me as a Christian. This idea that everything had a beginning has to be explained. And this term we use called the Big Bang is really just a term we're talking about that everything has a moment of cosmic singularity in which everything we see in the universe leaps into existence. And when I say everything we see in the universe, I'm talking about everything. This doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me that there's a big bang, right? Because if there's a big bang, well, every big bang requires a big banger. I just happen to know who that is, right? So I'm not uptight about this idea that science demonstrates that everything leapt into existence from nothing. I'm not upset about that at all. And when I say everything from nothing, what I mean is everything, space, time, and matter comes into existence from nothing. And that means that whatever starts that cannot be made up of that stuff. You cannot create yourself. That means I'm looking for a big banger that is not made up of the stuff of the universe, because that's what begins to exist at the beginning of the universe. Those elements do not exist prior to the beginning. That's what all science demonstrates. That means I'm looking for a non-spatial, non-temporal, non-material big banger. Think about it. If the stuff in the room is space, time, and matter, I'm already outside the room for the first explanation. Right? So I want to just dispel you of your nervousness about Big Bang cosmology. The standard cosmological model is indeed called the Big Bang Theory. And what I mean when I say that to you tonight is that I mean that the Big Bang Theory equals one important truth. Everything came from nothing. All space, time, and matter came from nothing. Are we on the same page so far? Here's what I don't mean when I say that I believe in the Big Bang. I'm not saying that I believe in the theory of evolution. These are two completely different theories. One theory talks about the origin of the universe. The other talks about change over time in the universe. I can accept this and reject this. Lots of people do. I can also reject this and accept this. Lots of people do. These are not the same thing. Make sense? Also, I am not suggesting that because I believe in the Big Bang, that I believe that the universe is a particular age. How long ago did that happen? That's open for discussion. We can argue about that. I have no problem arguing about that. But that's not what the Big Bang theory is I'm talking about. I'm talking about the Big Bang cosmology argues for one overarching truth. Everything came into existence from nothing. And I think you and I, we agree with that. That's called Genesis 1. So are we clear so far on this? So I have stopped kind of resisting. You want to bring on the Big Bang? Bring it on. Now, as I said before, there are several lines of evidence that point to the same thing. If you want an evidence or a demonstration that God exists, how about this? When I teach this class at Biola, I spend 17 hours covering this material. I could lock the doors and force you to stay here for 17 hours until we talk about all this, but I'm not going to do that. Therefore, there is a God. Okay, so I've already proved it. So I don't know why I even continue. What I want to do is just cover a couple of things that are in this list, because I think they're interesting. For example, the evidence that I thought was compelling were a couple of lines that I thought were really interesting. One is from an astrophysicist who is not a believer, who is named Robert Jastrow. He's been dead for a little while now. He was the director of the Goddard Institute. And he talked about an important line of evidence that's simply known as the second law of thermodynamics. Now, look, I know we didn't come in here tonight to talk about science, okay? Tough. We're talking about science, all right? Because this second law of thermodynamics actually is important to us. And what it really means, and I'll read it to you, is while the quantity of energy within a closed, isolated system, like the universe, remains the same, the amount of usable energy deteriorates gradually over time. In other words, the usable energy is irretrievably lost. It's lost. And as it is lost, increase of disorganization and randomness occurs. Chaos increases. You already kind of know this because you've experienced different simple demonstrations of the second law in your own lives. You see that things don't move from disorder to order. Things move from order to disorder. Things don't become newer and have more energy over time. In fact, just the opposite occurs. Things age and decay over time. And you see this over and over again. Right? If you have any doubts, go home and look at your bedroom. This will prove it to you right away. I mean, everything does this. The fact that we have death, why do you think we don't live forever? We don't live forever because of the second law of thermodynamics. We're not eternal beings. Everything has a shelf life. Let's put this down. How does this help us to demonstrate that the universe has a beginning? Well, let me ask you this. If you came in here tonight and you were the first person to walk in the room, there's nobody else here. You're the only person. It's dead quiet. Yet in the middle of the room, there's a little wind-up police car running around in circles. What's the first thing you're going to look for? Who wound it, right? Because you know this thing does not have endless energy. This thing is slowing down. It's unwinding in front of your very eyes. But that means if it's unwinding, you can go backwards into a time in which there was a point at which it was tightly wound. The fact that the car is running out of energy in front of you demonstrates that that energy had a beginning. Make sense? Well, we're in a wind-up universe that is winding down in front of our eyes, which means if you run it in reverse, we know it's got a beginning in which it was tightly wound. Does that make sense? It's the simplest illustration I can possibly give you for this. Also, though, we know that the universe is expanding, and we know this through the work of many people, but one of which you know probably the best is Edwin Hubble, who in his telescope started to kind of capitalize on concepts that others had discovered, and he noticed something called the law of redshift. Now, what he noticed is if you're looking and measuring light spectrum through of distant objects in the galaxies in the universe, if those objects are moving in one direction, they give you one type of light shift. So, for example, if they are coming toward you, they bend toward blue in the light spectrum. If they're moving away from you, though, they bend toward red. And as he looked out at the universe, he realized that things are bending toward red. In other words, things are moving away from us. The universe is expanding. And why does that matter? Well, think of it this way. If we had a balloon and on there we drew galaxies, as this expands, you're going to see that these are going to start moving away from no matter where you are. If you're here, if you're here, if you're here, if you're in the middle of this whole thing, no matter where you are, each point of data is moving away from you. Make sense? That's what we're seeing. Now, why does that matter? Because it's run the clock backwards. That means there's a point in time in which all these things were tightly condensed. And from that point of cosmic singularity, everything is expanding. So between this and the second law of thermodynamics, we have two good reasons to believe that we are in a universe that is expanding. And therefore, it has a beginning from which it expands. Does that make sense? Let me give you a third thing. It's called radiation echo. I love this because the people who actually discovered this discovered it by accident. Their names are Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. They built this marvelous satellite dish out of wood. Is that awesome? Here they are years later in front of the same dish. I thought it was pretty cool. They actually got a picture of them. They discovered they were hearing this background noise as they were listening to the universe, and they were trying to get rid of the background noise, and they had asked their friends, what do you think is causing this background noise? And someone said, well, hey, look at your dish, man. It's pretty dirty. Got bird poop all over it. Why don't you clean your dish? So they cleaned the dish. They could never get rid of the background noise until somebody said, well, wait a minute. Maybe that noise is not an artifact of your satellite dish. Maybe that noise is something that's really in the universe. It is. It's called cosmic background radiation. We have now, since this time, launched satellites. Here's one, Kobe, not Kobe Bryant, but Kobe, the cosmic background explorer, who this satellite now has actually photographed the background radiation of the universe, and it's pretty uniform across the universe. There is background radiation noise, heat, in the universe, this radiation echo. What could cause that? Well, let me give you another illustration that might help you. You know, I was on SWAT for 3 years. It was the best, funnest time I spent on my law enforcement while I was undercover for 4. That was actually funner. But this was not bad. And if we had somebody who was a barricaded suspect in a room, well, we knew if we were going to just charge through the door and try to get that guy, we're probably going to get hurt because he's going to see us coming. So what we would do instead is we would stage somebody on the other side with a flashbang. A flashbang is a canister, and there's a reason why they call it a flashbang. We're so creative. You know why they call it a flashbang? Because it does two things. That's right. That's right. So what you do is you get this guy staged with his hand grenade, basically, and he throws the hand grenade in through a window, and then it's going to explode. And as soon as it explodes, guess what? We're going to rush him from the other side because we're going to have his attention diverted to the noise of the flashbang. And what we discovered when we got inside the room here almost all the time is that once you get in that room after that bang, like your ears are ringing. There's dust everywhere. There's still heat in the room. Why? Because this explosive moment of the flashbang has got a couple of seconds of linger. Follow me? This is what we're seeing with cosmic background radiation. From that singular event of the beginning of the universe, we still have radiation in the universe, which is the afterglow of the singularity. Does that make sense? And we can measure it. And we've tried to explain it any number of ways. The best explanation is it's like a flashbang. It's still there. So now you've got three lines of evidence. Let me give you a fourth. This might cause you to stretch a little bit. This might explain how you might have the beginning of space and matter, but how do we explain the fact that we believe we are in a universe in which time also began at the beginning? Really? Time has a beginning? Yeah. You hear that expression all the time, before time began, but they're actually... It's kind of hard to say that because can you use a word, temporal word, like before if there's no time to measure before with? But anyway, the point is, I want you to look at it this way, like a racetrack. This is called the law of infinite regress. Imagine you're on this racetrack, and I put you at the starting line, and I say, okay, get ready, all of you. We're going to have a race. This race is wide enough, the track's wide enough that all of us can run simultaneously. Wouldn't that be awesome? Some of you in this room are really fast. Some of you are pathetic old people like me. I can tell you who's who. I can see all you people, okay? I can tell you who's probably going to win and what losers are in the room. I'll tell you right now, I can see you, okay? If you've got gray hair, I'm sorry. You're going to come in toward the back. I know. This is the way it is. That's me too. Now, if I put you on that track and I said, we're going to run to the end of that track, there's a finish line, and the first person to get, but we're not going to, there's no curve. What if this racetrack went off into the distance woods out there? It went off infinitely. What if that was the track we had? It went off infinitely past the finish line and infinitely past the start line. It's like an infinite racetrack. That's what you're standing on, at the starting line, and you're getting ready. You put your blocks in the ground. You push them down, put your little, you're set, you're good. You put your feet in the blocks, you're ready to take off. I get my starting pistol up in the air, I'm ready to start your race. You ready? Get set? Stop. I'm not gonna go. I want you to do me a favor before you start. Everyone back your blocks up 6 inches. Really? Yeah, just do it. Okay, you do it. Ready? Set? Stop. Back it up 6 inches. Are you kidding me? Yeah. And then every time that I'm about to start the race, every time, rather than let you get started, I tell you to stop and move your blocks back 6 inches. I never let you start. I make you move your blocks back infinitely. Are you ever going to get to the finish line? Think about it. Are you? No. If there's no start to the race, you're never going to get to the finish line. What if the finish line is just today? If there's no start to the race, you don't get to the finish line. And if there's no start to time, you can't get to today. The fact that we are at today demonstrates that there's a beginning to time. Are you with me on that one? Law of infinite regress. We know we are in a universe in which space, time, and matter has a beginning. So here's our diagram. We didn't even talk about helium, which we could, or mathematics, which we could. I just want you to see the case is, remember Dennis talked about a cumulative case? When we do these in front of juries, they look like this. They are cumulative cases built on several lines of evidence that all point to the same conclusion. Now look, people will say all the time, well, Jim, I don't know. I don't know. I just don't think, how do I know that I hear objections all the time. And by the way, atheists do not like the idea that we have a beginning to our universe. They are working hard to get rid of the beginning. Because if there is a big bang, there's a big banger. We got to explain what that is. And the big banger has to be non-spatial, non-material, non-temporal. So it's already starting to sound like God. So they've offered other alternatives. And they're all lame, okay? Now, when I hear defense attorneys try to offer alternatives, I can see where they're going to go wrong. They always go wrong in one of the same three ways. Always. All defensive mistakes from defense attorneys make a mistake in one of these three categories. One, they do something that's not supported by evidence, or they redefine a term, or they just have a logical contradiction. And all three explanations, all four or five explanations I see for the universe that are trying to explain it from not being God, fall for one of these same three reasons. Let me show you what I mean. One explanation is, hey, couldn't we just be in a universe that's been expanding eternally? Okay. Could it just be that the universe is cycling between expansion and contraction, like a heartbeat? And we just happen to be on the expansion side right now. That's one possibility. Couldn't it just be that the universe is part of a larger environment that's eternal? And our universe is a part of a larger collection of multiverses. Now, the first two would keep us inside the room for an answer. This one here, if you're in a multiverse, well, then you have a multiverse generator. That's something that's outside of space-time, and you're outside the room to get this multiverse generator, something that generates a number of universes. But these, all three of these explanations would eliminate God. So since I have a few minutes, I'm going to torture you a little bit. I want to give you the more academic view of this. I want you to see it really quickly. Here's the first question. Could the universe be cycling eternally? By the way, let's go back for a second. You see this explanation here? The ever-expanding universe that as it expands, more matter is created in the expansion voids. They have, for the most part, have walked away from that. There's no serious scientist who believes that anymore. So I'm just going to skip it and go to the ones they actually do believe, which are this one. Is it cycling eternally? This is something that Einstein kind of believed. Let me give you the model. The model looks like this. Imagine that instead of this being an expansion universe from a point in the past, what you have is over time, from all of eternity past to all of eternity future, the universe has been shrinking, pulling back from gravity, singularity, eventually slowed by gravity, back a singularity, and so over time, it gets large, then gravity pulls it back, singularity, large, gravity pulls it back, singularity. See what's happening here? This is one way. Now, we just happen right now in history to be at a point where what we're seeing is the expansion period. If we were over here, we'd be seeing a universe that's shrinking. That's the argument. Make sense? So we happen to be on the expansion side and not the decrease side. Now, one of the problems with this was discovered by another scientist whose name was Richard Tolman. And he said, wait a minute, the second law of thermodynamics, that's not going to work. Here's what he meant by it. What he meant was, okay, if I start here, all right, you may happen to see this thing is growing. You're at a point of growth, but you have less energy as time goes by. And so the next bounce will have less energy in it, and therefore the growth will be higher. And it'll be a slower, it'll be a longer distance between the next crunch and a higher arc before the next crunch. Why? Because energy is dissipating. But if you run that in reverse, it means it's going to get tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter in the past, and you're still stuck with the beginning. Follow me? So he would argue that even in this kind of cyclical universe, you're still stuck with the beginning because of the second law of thermodynamics. But a bigger question is, do you think it's really true that there's enough gravity, enough matter in the universe close enough in proximity so that gravity would ever really pull it back? That's the argument. The argument is at some point it slows because of gravity and it pulls back. The problem is the science doesn't demonstrate this. This researcher from Notre Dame, he's talked about it in several writings. His name is Peter Garnovich, and he says this: we cannot make much of a conclusion. By the way, they're making this by looking out at the universe at other supernovas. And he says, we cannot make much of a conclusion from a single farthest supernova we've seen, but when we average it with several others, here's the money line, we find to a 95% level of confidence that the density of matter is insufficient to halt the expansion of the universe. In other words, this could never happen anyway because there's not enough matter in the universe for gravity to slow its growth. So this whole idea of an expanding and collapsing cyclical universe doesn't work. Well, maybe it's part of a larger eternal environment. In other words, by the way, lots of people think this. You've got Alexander Vilenkin, who believes in a multiverse, and he's got theories about this. And then you have a guy who maybe you're familiar with, his name is Lawrence Krauss. And Lawrence had been in some trouble recently, but but he is an ASU, Arizona State University, a quantum physicist, and he's got some theories also. These are the most popular theories out there. I just want to cover them with you. You guys have heard of multiverses, right? Here's the idea for how multiverses come together. They're saying there's a quantum environment in which universes pop into existence from nothing at a very small quantum level. Then these quantum level particles grow into universes. So it's been illustrated by way of a boiling pot of water. And so the pot is the environment in which universes emerge. Follow me? And like little bubbles, they start off small and then they grow. And as these grow and they get larger, they turn into not just quantum level particles of energy, but they turn into entire universes. Now you might wonder, well, wait a minute, if that's true, I would expect then that at some point when the universes get really big, that they're going to bump into each other like bubbles do at the top of the water, right? So we should have some evidence from the collision of universes that we do have a multiverse environment, right? Oh, no, we don't see that. By the way, there's virtually no good evidence for multiverse theory at all to begin with, but we would expect to see these collisions, and so they asked that question. Why aren't I seeing those collisions then? Oh, well, because the pot is also growing. And the pot is actually growing at a slightly faster pace than the universe is, therefore they'll never come into contact with each other. Really? Now, when Vilenkin saw this was the theory, he had something to say about it. Here's what he said. He said, really? Okay. This is, in fact, not possible. If this is growing, okay, then you can't avoid a singularity. It's not, in fact, possible in future eternal inflationary space-times as long as they obey some reasonable physical conditions. Such models must necessarily possess initial singularities. Here's the point in English. Ready? If this is also expanding like the universe, the expansion of the universe demonstrates the universe had a beginning, right? Well, the expansion of the pot demonstrates the pot has to have a beginning. You haven't avoided the problem of a singularity. You just pushed it back one level. Got it? So even if there's a multiverse generator out there that's also expanding, you're still stuck with, how did that thing get here? But it's worse than that. Because the question is, what is this thing made of? Remember, there's no space, time, or matter until the beginning of our universe. Space is not nothing, guys. Space is something. There's not even a void you could call space. That's something. That didn't exist until the universe. Wrap your head around that for a second, okay? What if space is not nothing, it's something. What is nothing? It's what Aristotle says. It's what rocks dream about. Nothing. Now, why is this important? Because this is what Krauss says. Krauss says this. Now look, a universe can come into existence from nothing because the definition of nothing has changed. Physics has changed what we mean by nothing. Empty space is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles popping in and out of existence. If you wait long enough, that kind of nothing will always produce particles that eventually turn into universes. Well, wait a minute. Hang on. Hold on. We're trying to explain how all space, time, and matter came into being from nothing. And here's what Lawrence says. He says, well, if you start with empty space... No. Lawrence, we're trying to explain where that came from. He says, well, if you start with that, and then you get some virtual particles popping... No, Lawrence, we're trying to explain where that came from too. He said, now he's got space and matter energy in there, right? And then he says, get this, if you wait long enough, so now you've got time too. So basically he's saying, hey, if I got space, time, and energy, I can get space, time, and energy. Duh! I know that. Yeah, you just redefine what nothing is to suit your purposes. That doesn't work. You guys have all done this. I know you have. Remember when you were a kid and you go home and you open up the refrigerator at your mom's house and you see in the refrigerator you're starving. It's after school. You're starving. And this is her refrigerator? What's the first thing you're going to say? There's nothing to eat in here. Why? Because you've redefined nothing. There's a bunch of stuff in there you could eat. So if you want to stay inside the room to explain how the room got there, there's two ways to do it. You could say that there's some way that I could either redefine time or somehow I could be expanding. I can answer questions in the Q&A if you want to go more on that. But the problem with that, of course, is it requires you to redefine something. That doesn't work. Or you could say we have some oscillating growth and expansion and contraction, but that's not supported by the evidence. The third option is a multiverse theory, but the multiverse theory does not allow you to stay in the room because that multiverse generator is outside the room. So if you're going to go this way, you're going to have to jump out of the room. Now, the problem with that, of course, is you've already said to me that I believe there's an external cause for the universe. Okay. But your cause is somehow got space, time, and matter. But we know that doesn't exist. My cause is not spatial, temporal, or material. It actually fits the evidence. Your cause doesn't anymore. Because he's doing that little trick. That little trick where he uses this language, but then he steals space, time, and matter. Right? Yeah. If you have all that, you can get it. On the other hand, if there's an all-powerful, non-spatial, non-temporal, right, non-material, personal being that could create all of this outside the box, that explains everything. And it fits the evidence. It fits the physical evidence. So again, here we are. We started with this inside or outside the box view. And I told you that, remember, that intruders are the things that turn death scenes into crime scenes. And I told you also that you have to take that sense of curiosity you have and shift it toward a sense of urgency, which is why I spend so much time traveling and making this case in front of church groups who are not yet ready to make the case to others. You are the last line of defense. You should be able to make this case. And you should see a certain level of urgency. Now look, I didn't talk about all this stuff, but I actually think that the best explanation for all of this is outside the room. Now, I will tell you this, too. If you're going to, I get to a death scene, and I get there, right, and there's a dead person on the floor, I actually can tell you something about the suspect before I ever meet him or her. And I can tell you that just based on the evidence in the room. So, for example, if somebody is killed, he's shot at a 7-Eleven or AM, PM, what do you call those out here? Just like a gas station, a mini mart, okay? And he's shot, and there's money missing from the teller. From the cash register. He's been shot twice. Okay. If the same guy is killed in his bedroom, stabbed 70 times in the groin, two different kind of suspects, would you agree? Which of those two suspects knows my victim personally? Hey, that makes a big difference. Because if I'm looking for the guy who shot him at the gas station, that's all of us are suspects. If I'm looking for the guy or the gal who killed him in his bedroom by stabbing him in the groin 70 times, that's a much smaller pool of suspects. Agreed? One of those cases is easy to solve. The other one's not. I learned something about suspects just from the evidence in the scene. And that's true here too. I can draw a suspect profile. By the way, we've not talked about anything in Scripture. That entire book says nothing from Scripture. You can make a case for the God of the Bible without ever opening the Bible. Because this evidence is going to give you a suspect description. I have to explain those eight pieces of evidence. Only one kind of suspect can explain those. My suspect is not Mick Jagger. Right? He's been arrested several times if he's still alive. But he can't explain the evidence because the suspect I'm looking for is something that's non-spatial, non-temporal, that is purposeful and driven, that can create intelligently, can communicate and create life with DNA in the genome, that can actually design and be the designer behind the design we see in biology, who designs and creates in its own image other beings that have minds and free agency, who is also the standard of all righteousness by which we judge anything as moral, including the absence of certain acts that we would judge as evil. That's the kind of suspect I'm looking for. And this dude does not get it done. Of course, there is a suspect who would meet the criteria. Now, there's a case I did a number of years ago where this man killed his girlfriend. He was 27 when he killed her. He's 63 when I prosecuted him. We had several lines of evidence. We had some eyewitness statements. We had some behaviors he, as a young man, did. We had some physical evidence at the crime scene. And we had some statements he made. These are very different lines of evidence, and that's why the case was so strong. Two of these are simply eyewitness statements. Two of these are from behavioral sciences. Two of these are from forensic physical sciences. Two of these were just from studying his forensic statement analysis. When you have very different disciplines that point to the same suspect, you probably have the right guy. Here we have eight pieces of evidence that point to the same causal agent. And they are in very, two are cosmological, two are biological, two are mental, two are moral. These are very different disciplines, and very different kinds of scientists are used. These are astrophysicists and cosmologists. These are molecular biologists and microbiologists. These are ethicists over here at least. These are neuroscientists and philosophers. These are ethicists and philosophers. All of these people are pointing to the same kind of suspect. That's not a bad inference from evidence. Now, by the way, I will tell you that defense attorneys will try to knock this down. And I know how they're going to do it because I happen to deal with it all the time. They're going to say, Jim, I can think of other explanations for this. Heck, I can think of four possible explanations. I can think of three possible explanations for this. I can think of four for that and five for this and three for that. I can think of all these other possible explanations. And they do. They do. And by the way, none of them agree. So this guy says, this is my explanation for the beginning of the universe. This guy says, you're wrong. This is the right explanation. This guy says, you're both wrong. That's the right explanation. And by the way, whatever explanation you're using for this, none of those are available over here. So I need this amazing, crazy array of unrelated coincidences. Now, there's another way to explain this evidence. It might just be that all the same evidence could be explained by one causal agent. One causal agent that gets all of it done. Not this crazy set of unrelated, unlikely explanations. No, just one explanation that will unify all of the evidence. Which is more reasonable? Now, you've heard Hawking spent his entire life trying to find a theory of everything that would unify quantum physics to macro physics, to classic physics, Newtonian physics. He died without being able to do. I'm here to tell you, I've discovered the theory of everything. It's God. That's it. It's God. And this is what we're talking about in this book called God's Crime Scene. Okay, now that being said, we're running out of time, so I want to be respectful of your time. I wanted to show you, this is the one shameless plug I'm going to make tonight for the entire weekend. So when I first started doing this, I just wanted to kind of make a case for, number one, for Christianity. That's called God's Crime Scene. And I want to make a case for God's existence. That's called Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. And finally, I realized that a lot of churches, a lot of us as Christians, do not think we need to make the case for anything. Why do you need to make a case for anything? You just believe, right? I needed to write a book that made a case for making the case. And that's called forensic faith. And of course, we've got kids' versions of all three of these books. The kids' versions for this book comes out in about a month. That's my dog, Bailey, by the way. And the kids' versions have an online academy that you can actually take. And if you take the academy and do all the materials on the academy, you can send me your picture and we post them to hold in their certificates of graduation. So, yes, everyone go, aw, together. Ready? One, two, three, aw.
What's it like seeing a dead body at a crime scene?
Yeah, I think, you know, I get that question a lot. When my dad was a cop before me, I remember we had a case which we were actually getting ready to do a show, a TV show, a series. And one of the cases we were submitting was my dad's old case. And I remember I was 13 years old. I was just getting interested in law enforcement. And he took me down to the station and he showed me this case from 1972 in which four people were executed by this killer. And I thought, I can watch this, no problem. I got about maybe 5 minutes into the video, and it was just a black and white video, 16-millimeter film. I said, turn it off. I can't watch it. I think he might have thought, well, this kid's never going to be able to do this work. But there's, unfortunately, a certain amount of you get desensitized the more you look at dead people. Until finally, it's no big deal, right? And it's just probably why people who work in mortuary and funeral homes, they can do the work. right? Because they're constantly handling dead people. Get over it, right? And so that's what happens, is the more you do it, the more comfortable you get with it. That's probably not a good thing, but it's just the way it is. Otherwise, you'd never be able to do the work. Because you're going to have to be called out in the middle of the night to murder scenes, and you're going to have to be able to walk in and eventually move bodies around and be looking for stuff. And if you can't touch dead people...
That's disturbing.
All right.
But we're glad you're here.
You know what? When we were first looking at doing a series, you know, a television series, I watched one episode of every show on ID Channel. Just one episode of each show. To see what works, what doesn't work, what's good, what's a good approach. And I think all the cops, you look at all those shows, have a similar... If you've done this job for very long, you all have the same approach. Sadly.
Second question. So somebody pointed out, the crime scene here that you started off with, that analogy is a large one.
Yes.
The whole universe. And it's really cold. Mm-hmm. Billions of years old or whatever, potentially.
Yes, yes.
We fill in the answers here with these explanations don't work, these ones don't, these don't. And so you've put God in the gap there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So several were bringing up that this sounds like a God from the gap argument.
Okay. So let me go back to this for a second. I very much understand and appreciate that. So let's take a look at our cumulative case, just to see what this looks like for a second. What we're looking at is all of us have a burden to explain these eight things. All of us do. We do. It's not just me. It used to be, well, you're proposing that there's a God that I can't see, therefore the burden's on you to explain something that I don't see. If you're positing there's some, fairy God out there, great, but that's the burden's on you to prove it. That's not how this works at crime scenes. At crime scenes, we get there and I say, okay, look, I see all this evidence. I think the husband did this. And my partner says, you're crazy. Her sister did this. Really? Okay, well, I'm going to give you the five reasons, the burden that I feel I bear to demonstrate that the husband did this. But you have an equal burden because you think those same pieces of evidence point to the sister. Okay, great. You have that burden. Each of us has a burden to explain why we think our cause can account for the evidence. So I'm not the only one who carries a burden here. I have a burden. I think that a spaceless, timeless, all-powerful, immaterial, personal first cause can explain this. By the way, most of my friends who are atheists, we don't disagree on much. We all believe we're looking for a timeless, immaterial, non-temporal first cause. The only question is it personal or impersonal? That's it. Is it some law that is impersonal that causes all this to come into being? Or is there I think that the burden then is, if you think you can get this with space, time, and matter, show me. No problem. Oh, you've got like two theories that don't work, but you still think it's just space, time, and matter and physics? Science of the gaps.
Works both ways.
Your explanation's not working, but you still want to run with it. Okay, I get it. You just think, hey, I've got no... This is what they typically will say, too, by the way. This is not uncommon. I get it, Jim. We can't explain how life in the universe began, but we will eventually. How is that any different than I can't explain it, but I'll ask God later? It's the same exact approach. No, I looked at your explanations for this. They stink. Okay. But if you're committed that it has to be without a divine intervention, that's just science of the gaps. It's that you refuse to go to anything. Look, this, I think, points to personhood. Remember, if there are objective moral truths, like it's never okay to torture babies for fun, those aren't just moral claims. They're moral obligations. We feel objective, transcendent moral obligations. Now, think about that for a second. I am not morally obligated to inanimate objects made up of matter, physics, space, and time. I'm not morally obligated to this chair. It's impersonal. Impersonal object. I have no moral obligation to it. But a person who's sitting in the chair, I have a moral obligation to. If there are objective, transcendent moral obligations, who is the objective, transcendent moral person I'm feeling obligated? You're not obligated to physics or space or time. But you know there are certain moral obligations. The better explanation is a first causal agent that is personal. This isn't God of the gaps. It's reasoning to the most reasonable inference. To deny personhood in the first cause is science of the gaps. You can't explain this otherwise. You can't explain that. You realize that at least Sam Harris is an honest atheist. He says, yeah, you don't have free will. It's an illusion. Do you guys think that your free will is an illusion? If so, you're not really thinking right now, because you can't have rationality without freedom. You've got to consider two options and freely choose which one you think makes more sense. But if you can't freely choose the options, you're just destined to believe me or destined not to believe me. It was predetermined. You don't believe that. Sam Harris does believe that. Then why write a book, Sam? You trying to convince me? What's the point of that? I can't be convinced. I can't be changed. I can't change my mind. I either agree with you or I don't. See my problem? So I would say, no, it's not that it's a God of the gaps to infer this. The same burden is on the other person. Then it's just science of the gaps if you don't. Mm. What it really comes down to is this the best explanation, best inference from evidence?
All right, last one. Several people wrote in. I think they're leading questions, but they're like, so what?
Yeah.
Sort of like you asked him, so what? You wrote this book about this. So what if God's the answer to this?
So that's the question? So yeah.
So what?
Got it. Well, okay, let me ask you a question. Do you think it matters? Do you think we would behave differently if none of us believed there was any purpose to life? Do you think we'd behave differently? I think you would. Now, why do we think there's a purpose to life? You could say, well, I create my own purpose to life. So if I was to find out something, let's say I was to come alongside this, and I discovered this thing sitting on the counter. Okay? And here it is. It's this little widget. So here's a little widget here. It's sitting here. And I'm finding that on the counter. I'm like, dang, what is that for? What is the purpose of this widget? If you didn't know the purpose of this widget, honestly, you didn't know, but you wanted to find out tonight what the purpose of the widget is, what would you do? What would you? You'd Google it. No, listen. Okay, but you could do that. Look, I could say, well, look, it could be a number of things. I could use it to hold open a door. It's a door, it's got an angle. I could put it in a doorstop. I could find other uses for this. I could. I could use it to prop up my keyboard. I could find other uses, but I really want to know what was it designed for? Because it seems to me I'll get the most out of it if I know what its intended purpose was. Well, how do I find that? You're going to Google it. Okay, fine. So how are you going to Google it? What are you going to look for? What if I told you that there was a manufacturer on the side? You type this in, right? Okay, fine. So now it turns out what you're thinking is that the best way to discover the purpose of this widget is to ask the manufacturer. Okay. So now you know why it matters.
Sweet man.
Okay.
Hey, this is great stuff, and you appreciate how clearly you're able to present it. So
keep in mind, all of you who are here tonight for a reason, you're here for a purpose. You happen to be in a great church. I mean, honestly, this is so rare. I get to speak all over the country. Do not take this for granted. I don't take you for granted, because the amount of passion and interest I see in this room, I'm astonished, truly. So don't take this for granted. And what we're doing here is not so you can be smarter. This is not about data consumption, where I'm here to give you more data to consume. That's not what we're doing. What we want you to do is to change the planet with truth. And that takes two things. I'm standing up again. That takes two things. That takes, you have to know enough about what is true. But then you have to think about how you're going to deliver it. And what we want to do with juries is we could have the truth, but if we don't communicate it well, we don't win the jury. And by the way, the jury is paying attention to us from the moment we get off the elevator. They're waiting around in the hall, and they're watching us. They're watching our interaction with each other. And it's not like this thing starts when we start to make the case. No, it starts out in the hallway. Your world is watching you right now. So character does matter. But character without truth, and to be able to master that and communicate that. So we are doing this tonight to put those two things together. It's not just that I want you to know why it's true. I want you to be able to remember how we just communicated it so you can do that too. Make sense? Yeah. All right, let's pray. Father, we love you and we know that you have a task for us. You have so much more for us than we even know today. So help show us what it is you want us to do this week. Give us a divine appointment with somebody this week that requires us to bring to mind all the stuff that we're learning right now. Don't let it just be a way for us to be entertained. Help us to use the truth to change our world. We pray this in the name of your precious Son, Jesus Christ. And everyone here says,
amen.
I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Thanks a lot.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.